The roll call be dispensed with and the Sergeant-at-Arms be instructed to bring in the absent members.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Today's chaplain is Reverend David Colby from Central Presbyterian Church in St. Paul. And following the prayer, please remain standing for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Let us pray. Holy God, as the Minnesota Senate gathers, we begin with gratitude. We give you thanks for this day, for the beauty that might be revealed, and for moments of joy and wonder that will be experienced amidst the hectic pace of activities. We give you thanks for a moment for silence. Help us to listen today to those whom we represent, to our conscience, and to those speaking to us. Give us humility, O God. Remind us that you are greater than any one of us, that we might never assume that we have the full truth. So help us also to listen to those with whom we contend, those with whom we disagree, to those even who anger us. Keep us open to wisdom and truth, respectful of others, courageous and strong. Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States Republic, for which it stands, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you.
Secretary will take the roll.
Senators Bach, Benson, Bonhoff, Brown, Carlson, Chamberlain, Cohen, Dames, Daly, DeKreif, Dibble, Dietzick, Eaton, Fischbach, Gazelka, Gerlach, Gimsey, Goodwin, Hall, Han, Harrington, Hayden, Higgins, Hoffman, Howe, Ingebrigtsen, Jungbauer, Kielash, Koch, Cruz, Kubli, Langseth, Latz, Lilly, Limmer, Laurie, Magnus, Marty, McGuire, Metzen, Michelle, Miller, Nelson, Newman, Nino, Olson, Ortman, Pappas, Perry, Peterson, Reinert, Rest, Roebling, Rosen, Saxog, Senjum, Sharon, Sieben, Skoy, Sparks, Stump, Thompson, Tomasoni, Torres, Ray, Vandeveer, Uyghur, Wolf.
A quorum is present. Moving to the fifth order of business, the reports of committees. Senator Senjum.
Madam President, I move that the committee reports printed on the agenda be adopted with the exception of the reports pertaining to appointments.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Senator Senjum.
Madam President, I move that the report pertaining to appointments be laid on the table.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Moving to the seventh order of business, the second reading of House bills. There's one House file printed on page 2 of today's Senate agenda, second reading. Eighth order of business, introduction and first reading of Senate bills. They are printed on today's Senate bill introductions. They will be referred as indicated, first reading. Moving to the ninth order of business, motions and resolutions. There are four authors' motions that are printed on today's Senate agenda on page 2. They will be taken as one motion. On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Senator Han.
Thank you, Madam President. I apologize for being away from my desk. I would move that Senate File 1738 be withdrawn from the Committee on State Government and Innovation and Veterans and refer to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection.
To that motion, Senator Han.
Thank you, Madam President. This is a bill that has to do with PEEP insurance and its effect on the MCHA structure, which is in the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee. It does not have any fiscal note attached to it, so wanted to have it heard in the Commerce Committee.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Senator Senjum.
Madam President, remaining under the orders of business and, motion and resolutions, I do now move that the Senate take up the calendar.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. There are Senate calendars available here. There are two bills on the Senate calendar. Secretary will give Senate File 576 its third reading. Excuse me.
Senate File Number 576, a bill for an act relating to agriculture. Third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 576. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 62 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Continuing on the Senate calendar, secretary will give House File 392 its third reading.
House File Number 392, a bill for an act relating to education, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on House File 392. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 64 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Senator Senjum.
Madam President, members, remaining on the order of business of motions and resolutions, I move that the Senate take up the general orders calendar.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Senator Senjum.
Madam President, members, I move that the Senate do now resolve itself into the Committee of the Whole for purposes of taking up the general orders calendar.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. We can just go. My understanding is there has been a order distributed. So, Senator Senjum.
Madam President, members, you're right. There should be an order on your desk. We'll start with number 7, Senate File 1527, Senator Dames, and we'll go probably to around 12:30.
Senator Dames.
Madam Chair, I move that when the committee do arise, Senate File 1527 be recommended to pass. Senate File 1527 is a bill that pertains to getting certification for non-medicated feed. The need for the bill is created in the fact that currently we do not have the ability at the federal or the state level to issue non-medicated feed good manufacturer's practice certificates. The country of Brazil now requires a good manufacturing standard practice certificate in order for the exports from the United States to be imported into Brazil. And the country of Mexico will be following shortly along the same process. The Food Modernization Act of 2011, which is a federal program, is not ready to go yet. They will be issuing their proposed rules during the early part of 2012, and then we'll have an extended comment period. And the final rules are expected to be coming out later this calendar year. So we need to come up with a temporary fix, and so this bill will do that. This bill will allow the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to create certification guidelines, inspect the plants, and then also the fees for the certification and the fees for the inspections will be charged back to the business that's getting the inspection done. This will meet the needs of the Brazilian country and in the future meet the needs of the country of Mexico. And these will be temporary guidelines, and these guidelines will be replaced by the federal guidelines when they are issued. And once those guidelines are issued and will be finalized later this year, they will be adopted by reference to provide for quick transition in Minnesota. In conclusion, the temporary good manufacturing practice process set forth in this bill will allow Minnesota companies to meet the new Brazilian import requirements until such time as the new Federal Food Safety Modernization Act is implemented in Minnesota. Permanent regulation of the good manufacturing practices in non-medicated feed will come with the impending Food and Drug Administration final rules later this year. I would like to recognize and thank Jennifer Burquam for her hard work with the Department of Agriculture to get this bill put together. And at this point, I'll stand for any questions.
Further discussion on Senate File 1527. Seeing none, Senator Dames renews his motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1527 be recommended to pass. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Moving on to Senate File 1240, number 1 on general orders, Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1240 be recommended to pass.
To that motion, Senator Thompson.
Thank you. This bill before you, Senate File 1240, is a bill dealing with forfeiture, and I would like to thank my co-authors, Senators Latz, Harrington, Ortman, and Limmer. This is a bill that has the support of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, Institute for Justice, Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and the ACLU. We have vetted this with the law enforcement, and we are unaware of any objections from anyone on this bill. What this deals with is actually updating the law on forfeitures that currently is in place for all drug forfeitures. That law was fixed back a couple of years ago by the legislature, but has not been extended to non-drug forfeiture cases. And this bill would do a few very simple things. First off, it would extend, as I said, these forfeiture provisions to non-drug cases. It does not significantly change the law of what property can be forfeited, or I should say can be confiscated by law enforcement. It standardizes the procedures for property owners to try to get their property back in a criminal case where their property has been seized. And also by adopting these standards, law enforcement will reduce their paperwork and increase efficiency. But the provision in this bill that got me interested in it, members, is that under current law, It can happen that if you are picked up in a criminal case and have property seized, that you would have to start your civil proceeding to get your property back before the disposition of the criminal case. And the problem with that is you could theoretically have to make disclosures that could prejudice you in your criminal case. So this law makes a change so that you are able to file your action within 60 days to retrieve your property, get your property back that has been seized, but that proceeding would be stayed until after the completion of the criminal case so that you would not have to be trying to fight the civil case at the time your criminal case is pending. So it really is that simple. In summary, standardization of forfeiture in drug and non-drug cases allows people to fight their criminal case without having to be tied up in the civil system at the same time, and standardizes procedures to make things easier for law enforcement. And with that, I would be happy to take any questions that the members may have.
Further discussion on Senate File 1240. Seeing none, Senator Thompson renews his motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1240 be recommended to pass. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Moving on to number two on general orders, House File 382. Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, I move that when this committee do arise, House File 382 be recommended to pass.
To that motion, Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Once again, we have a bill here that I am unaware that there's any opposition. I'd again like to thank Senator Latz for co-authoring this piece of legislation. And this bill deals with the law of receiverships. And very simply, a receivership is created when a court orders typically a law firm or a business consulting firm to oversee the administration of assets. It may happen in the case of a business going bankrupt or being foreclosed upon by a creditor. It may happen in a divorce proceeding where property needs to be administered during the pendency of the action. And the need for this legislation arose because receiverships are referred to in over 300 places in Minnesota statutes. Consequently, for practitioners, it's very difficult to see the entire body of law at one time. This results in unnecessary litigation, and it bogs the courts down in disputes that should not happen. This legislation would do some very simple things. It would make some limited changes to existing law, most of which have already been litigated and are just being codified, would provide some transparency by eliminating some secret rules. It would limit the new scheme primarily to commercial matters and dissolutions, and it does not create any kind of bankruptcy substitute. So the bottom line is what we really have here, members, is a bill to promote efficiency within the administration of receiverships. Once again, this bill has been vetted and obviously gone through committee, and I am unaware of any opposition. Thank you.
Further discussion on House File 382. Seeing none, Senator Thompson renews his motion when this committee do arise, House File 382 be recommended to pass. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Moving to number four on the general orders calendar, Senate File 1236, Senator Perry.
Madam Chair, I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File number 1236 be recommended to pass.
To that motion, Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this is an innocent successor liability bill. The current rule of successor liability provides that when a predecessor merges with another corporation, the successor can be held liable without limit for the torts of the dissolved predecessor, even if the successor did nothing wrong and the activity of the predecessor that created the liability was terminated before the merger. In some circumstances, the rules can cause tremendous, tremendous injustice, as in the case of who I'm talking about today, Minnesota's Crown Cork and Seal, a company founded back in 1892 by the inventor of the bottle cap. Crown has operated in Minnesota for almost 50 years, and they have locations in Owatonna, Faribault, and Mankato. Together, they employ 415 employees. Crown's investment in the state is upwards of $300 million. This is a bipartisan bill, and I'd like to thank my co-authors, Senator Sharon and Senator Sparks and Senator Gerlach. I'm going to give you a little history of this bill to kind of set the stage here. In November of 1963, Crown, Cork, and Seal purchased the majority of the stock of Mundet Cork Company, which was also a small family cork and bottle cap company. Before the acquisition, Mundet had a side business that was making and installing asbestos and other insulation. But by the time Crown's stock purchase, however, Mundet had already closed its asbestos manufacturing operations. And approximately 90 days after Crown obtained its stock ownership and interest in Mundet, what was left in that particular company was nothing other than idle machinery, leftover inventory, and customer list. All of that was sold off by Mundet. Crown itself never operated an insulation division. However, Crown subsequently acquired Mundet stock, and Mundet, now having only bottle cap operations, was merged into Crown Cork and Seal back in January of 1966. The cost of the stock was approximately $7 million. This brief relationship with Mundet has cost Crown Cork and Seal over $750 million in asbestos-related expenses. Moreover, Crown Cork and Seal's credit rating has been reduced to junk status, and the company has subsequently been forced to pay junk bond interest rates on its borrowing, resulting in over $1 billion. To remedy such incidences of what some would call grossly disproportionate liability imposed on innocent companies, 15 states have changed and worked to alleviate the situation. Mississippi, Texas, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming. And we'll pass out a packet here that'll show you those states. We believe Minnesota should enact the same type of legislation to restore fairness to innocent successors while still providing plaintiffs allegedly harmed by the predecessor the right to collect from the successor what they have and could have collected if no merger had taken place. This legislation only applies to mergers that occurred prior to 1972. Why, you might ask? Well, because that's when OSHA asbestos regulations were adopted, making the danger of asbestos publicly known for the first time. Now, had the dangers of asbestos been publicly known prior to the merger, for an example in this case with Crown Cork and Seal, the merged company of Mundet back in 1966, an acquiring company would have simply just kept that asbestos-tainted acquired company as a subsidiary and never merged with it at all, ultimately going into bankruptcy. The successor asbestos-related liability reform legislation simply allows innocent successor companies that acquired and merged with asbestos-tainted companies prior to the promulgation of the 1972 OSHA asbestos regulations to be treated no worse than those companies that acquired asbestos-tainted companies after 1972. And finally, Madam Chair, enactment of the Council of State Governments model is essential as a matter of fundamental fairness, would benefit the over 400 Crown employees, 200 retirees who live in Minnesota and rely on Crown for wages, pensions, and health care benefits, as well as over 4,000 Crown Cork and Seal employees in the U.S. and almost 20,000 retirees and their dependents. This legislation would help preserve tax revenues that are related to Crown's manufacturing plants in Faribault, Mankato, and Owatonna. Madam Chair, I would stand for any questions.
Further discussion on Senate File 1236. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Roll call granted.
Madam Chair, I rise in opposition to this bill. This is special legislation to benefit one specific company, even though they are not named in the bill itself. That is clearly what this is about. They were the company that's been identified by the bill's author. They were the company that was identified in Judiciary Committee hearings this year and last year. The effective date reflects that. That would set a very, very dangerous precedent to pass a bill specifically for the purpose of exempting a company from civil liability in our justice system. But it's not only about that precedent, and I'll talk about that again in a moment. This is a bad bill for a number of other reasons on the merits. Number one, the facts are that Crown Cork knew or should have known of the liability that they were buying. And that is indeed what they did. They bought a company that had already experienced a number of asbestos-related claims in their workers' compensation policy. Mundet's own records, the company that was bought, their own records, and copies were shown in Judiciary Committee. Their own records showed a list of the asbestos-related work comp claims that they had already experienced. So, as the old saying goes, caveat emptor, indeed, Crown Cork knew what they were buying, or they certainly should have known, and whether they blame it on, you know, bad due diligence or whatever, I have been informed that, in fact, there are deposition transcripts from litigation in which Crown Cork acknowledged that they knew that Mundet had experienced asbestos-related liabilities before Crown Cork bought the company. So what they are trying to do now is to avoid liabilities that they purchased. Now, is that really fair? Is that fair to the injured workers or injured persons that were exposed to this asbestos? The manufacturers of asbestos have known since the 1930s that what they were selling was a product that had dangerous health effects on people who were exposed to it. So Crown Cork can't wear the mantle of an innocent successor no matter how many times they claim it. Now, they will also claim that this exposure for them is a substantial financial consequence. You will hear proponents say that they will use this money to reinvest in their manufacturing plants, that they have suffered on Wall Street having to pay higher interest rates, that it has impeded their growth as a company. The fact is, Crown Cork is a $7.5 billion multinational corporation that in their 2010 annual report stated that their potential liabilities in this area have no material adverse effect on the company's financial position. So, members, don't believe that this is going to harm this major multinational corporation if we don't pass this special legislation to shield them from civil justice liabilities. Now, the injured persons will have no other place to go if this bill passes, because there would be no other fund or corporation that they could hold liable. There is a national compensation fund for victims of asbestos-related injuries, mesothelioma, which is a deadly cancer, or asbestosis, or several other diseases. Those of you who are familiar with the Iron Range and the mines there know a lot about that kind of exposure.
If a company files for bankruptcy, that would otherwise be liable to the workers or the injured persons, there's a special national fund to cover bankrupt companies. But in this case, Mundet didn't file bankruptcy. They were acquired by Crown Cork. So any injured persons can't go to the special fund, and they, if this bill passes, wouldn't be able to go to Crown Cork either. So this bill would leave injured workers or others who were exposed without any adequate remedy at law. Workers who were installing the asbestos products, workers who work in buildings like the state capitol that have asbestos in them, and the families of people that have worked around asbestos. This would also create an incentive for other companies to come into this legislature to seek liability protections. Can you imagine if, and those of you who represent areas around 3M might want to listen carefully, can you imagine if 3M, which claims they did not know that the PFCs that are now been found to contaminate groundwater in East Metro were harmful or were not contaminating anything, if they came in and said, we were innocent because we didn't know, so shield us from liability, would you support that legislation? Where does it stop? Where do we say, no, the civil justice system is best suited to sort out these questions of liability? Members, this would open a dangerous door for all of us if this bill passes. The bill also provides some specific limits on the liability by allowing Crown Cork to determine the fair market value of the company that they bought, and that creating that hard cap on damages. So not only does it create a bar for liability, but it allows, in this case, the wolf to define the exact extent of their exposure. So for these reasons, I encourage members of this body to vote no on this bill. I guess I already asked for the roll call. So thank you very much.
Further discussion on Senate File 1236. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam President. I stand in support of this bill, and I wanted to just address a couple of points that were raised by Senator Latz. The first being that this bill applies only to one company. That's not true. This bill would apply to any similarly situated company that brought on this asbestos exposure through no knowledge of their own. So the fact that this bill was brought to our attention by one company, as the members well know, that is true of an awful lot of the things we do here that an individual business or an individual person brings to our attention, an issue that is very broad-based. In terms of the fact that there's no liability, in fact, that isn't true. Companies can be held liable to the extent that the assets they acquired are put at risk, but nothing more, which certainly makes sense when the only companies that would be protected by this legislation are companies that have in no way contributed to the harm that has come to this individual. Also, this does not apply to workers' compensation. So individuals that were exposed to asbestos during in the course and scope of their employment, to use the work comp language, would not be excluded from this. This is simply a tort liability issue and an attempt to chase down companies that were not in a business that exposed people to risk. And also, given the dates that apply here, prior to this time, there was no knowledge of the danger that existed due to the exposure to asbestos. So bringing this down to its simplest component, folks, what this bill does is it protects companies from significant financial liability and potentially destruction for diseases that are the result of a business they weren't in themselves and had no way to know at the time was even a danger. And I would strongly encourage the members to support this.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam President. I rise also in opposition to this legislation, and I just ask my colleagues, what about the innocent victims in these cases? This, Madam Speaker, Madam President, and members, is a business transaction. This is a business transaction between two willing business partners. They had people that created the transaction, they signed it, and two willing parties. You know, this is the free marketplace. This is what we want. We want people to be able to contract and do this. And then suddenly, one of the partners doesn't like the way the contract is working out. They suddenly have more liability than they thought, which one could argue they should have known about because it's very public that they should have known about the cases that were out there. So suddenly, one of the parties decides that they don't like this transaction anymore because now they owe some money. So then they come to the legislature for some for remedy. So I ask, what if one of the business partners had made millions of dollars? What if they made millions more than they thought they would? Could we then go and say, well, now you made millions more, could we take some of that? Because they're worried that they're making, that they have, you know, millions of dollars in settlements that are due to innocent victims, I might add. We're stepping in there, but what if they made millions more? We wouldn't be stepping in for that. And I'm very nervous about the precedents that this sets. So let's take a company, for example, that has acquired a lot of liabilities. They've actually created some product where it's creating harm to their employees, and they don't want to deal with it. So they arrange to be acquired. They arrange to be acquired by an innocent purchaser. So they get acquired, and then the innocent purchaser comes and says, okay, so they decide they don't want to know anything about this company that they're acquiring. And then they realize after they've acquired them that they have now a lot of liability. And then they come to the legislature and say, oh, no, now we have a lot of liability. We don't want it. And so we're going to come to you for help on this. So I think this is an amazingly dangerous precedence to set, where we've really inserted ourselves into the marketplace of businesses that are creating transactions. This was clearly an identifiable risk that they were taking, and they did it on their own. No one forced them to do this. And I might add that when I thought it was really specifically to one company, I was upset. But when I heard, as Senator Thompson said, this is very broad-based, this is really applying to a lot of places, then I'm really nervous about this bill because we have really inserted ourselves into the free marketplace. And I urge my colleagues to vote against this. This is bad precedent. This is bad for the state of Minnesota.
Further discussion, Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I'm appreciative, Madam President, for the opportunity to speak in favor of this bill. I would urge the members of the legislature to be cautious at the fears that are being raised by my colleagues, whom I have a great deal of respect, about the precedence that is being established by this legislation. We're hearing both that it's unique and it's not unique. And therefore, because if it's unique, then of course we aren't going to have a precedent-setting situation. But if it's not unique, then maybe there is a precedence possibility. But you have to read a little closer as to what makes this unique and why you need to be very careful about the warnings about the precedence setting. It is very specifically written in this legislation that only a company that buys an asbestos-related company and never profits, never makes a sale, never engages in money-making activities from which they could profit and then not be held responsible, as Senator McGuire was talking about, for the liabilities of the company after they're making profits. The language of this legislation limits the probability or even the possibility of that happening. So the language, as it's related, is unique to a situation, and it is such a narrow situation that it really does not provide a basis for precedence. Not that there aren't those who would try to go to court and establish this as a precedence, but the language is narrowly written in such a way that it is unique enough for the fears that are being raised about precedents to be worth taking in relationship to what the benefit of this legislation takes. I'd also like to talk about the issue of whether or not we should be concerned about whether or not this company was fully aware of the liability before purchasing the company or not, as was represented by Senator Latz. I would suggest to you that you should be cautious about that warning as well, because the issue of knowing liability or not should not be a factor in your decision. And the reason for that is because the point of the legislation is that we limit the liability, not excuse the liability, and it limits the liability to the fair market value of the company at the time of its purchase. Therefore, if this company had bankrupted, people would also lose all capacity to have liability at all. At least with this legislation, there is resources available to resolve asbestos-related issues and hold that company up to the value of the assets of that company. And as Senator Latz indicated, there is a national compensation fund and workman's comp as issues to assist persons with these injuries, and that is a more proper way, rather than hamstringing a company from using resources that are not related at all to the problems created by the purchase of an asbestos company from which they never profited or never engaged in activity. That there should be a solution. We should be concerned about those persons that are harmed because of work-related lack of safety, if it's out of a bankruptcy or in this situation, but that the remedy is not to create in law a situation that doesn't allow for us to take at a fairly unique situation like this and afford a remedy for this company. So I appreciate the opportunity to address my colleagues.
Further discussion, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam President. I just wanted to briefly respond to the issue of the identifying characteristics of the risk here. And I want to remark on the committee process. I will tell you that this matter was in our committee on at least two occasions that I recall. And I do not recall hearing any evidence or any information regarding depositions being available for us to examine, which indicated that this company had knowledge of an asbestos risk. In point of fact, I don't remember hearing anything about this risk of asbestos being known as far back as the 1930s. To the contrary, what I heard was that this was an unknown risk at the time that Crown Cork purchased the subject business, and there was no way for them to have known. And I think that's really important, is that in a situation going back 40 years, they didn't have the ability to know about the risk that they were supposedly taking on. And so in this instance, I'm going to rely on what I heard in the committee process as to the evidence that I'm going to rely on and support the passage of this bill. Thank you, Madam President.
Further discussion on Senate File 1236. Senator Marty.
Madam President, I guess I had a question for Senator Thompson or somebody, and that is, when I heard the bill addressed by Senator Perry, he talked about this being an innocent company, and he talked about the victims as being alleged victims or possible victims or something of that sort. And the fact is that some people were hurt by asbestos. Some of them get bad forms of cancer. A lot of them die from it. My question is, who should they have recourse with? Should the public provide funding for people who are sick and making sure that people who might get cancer and so on have care? If it's not the company that you're saying is an innocent company, even though they've made profits off of it, who should address the needs of these people? Because they are truly people, whether you're calling them apparent victims or not, they are people who have asbestos-related health issues, often cancer, often terminal. Who should take care of them? I don't mind if we want to change our whole system and not rely on the responsible companies or the, quote, non-responsible companies and say it should be the taxpayers. But I'm wondering, who should? Should we just say, well, you got cancer? Shouldn't have worked there. Should have known better. Because they have no other recourse in a case like this. So, Senator Thompson or Senator Perry, who should be responsible for these victims?
I believe Senator Thompson wanted to address that. Senator Thompson.
Madam President, thank you. I would like to address the issue raised by Senator Marty, and the answer is that if there is a legitimate tort case there, if somebody has committed a wrong that has resulted in the cancer-related disease, then the potential plaintiff would have a claim against the company that caused it. We're dealing here with the company that did not cause it. And by the way, yes, health insurance would cover that treatment. Health insurance doesn't ask how did the cancer come about. If the individual has health coverage, it would be covered. So the answer is twofold. Your health insurance would cover the medical problem, and if in fact there is a tortfeasor out there that wrongfully exposed you to the asbestos, you can still make that tortfeasor a defendant.
Further discussion. You guys, it was like a tie over there. I don't know who popped up first. Senator Latz. Sorry, Senator Marty, you came up for, I'm sorry.
Yes, Madam President, thank you. I did want to respond to Senator Thompson. And Senator Thompson, well, you know it or not, there are a lot of people who don't have health insurance. A lot of them have deductibles they can't afford to pay for it. So who is going to help them? Maybe this previous company was the one responsible, but you have no recourse against them. If they had declared bankruptcy, you might have some recourse. Not much, but you might have some, but they didn't declare bankruptcy, they sold to another company. And that's where you have your legal recourse. But we're saying here, no, we're not going to give you that legal recourse with them, so who should have it? Well, maybe they have health insurance, maybe that'll take care of it, maybe they can't work because they're so sick, even if they have health insurance, but nobody's there to help them at all. And I don't hear you asking that the taxpayers pick up more of the tab. So we're basically telling the people who get cancer or whatever from asbestos, tough luck. And that's not an okay solution. And saying that this company isn't as responsible as the company that they bought from is not an excuse to say they're not responsible at all and that the victim should be stuck with no recourse.
I have Senator Sharon and Senator McGuire. Do you have any preference on Senator Sharon? And just as a reminder, members, it's Madam Chairman right now. We are in the we're in the Committee of the Whole.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the chance to address a couple issues that have been raised. First of all, I couldn't agree with Senator Marty Moore on this issue, that it would be easier for many of my colleagues on the floor to be supportive of legislation like this if this same group of people who want tort reforms or protections from companies, from insurance claims, would advocate for funding for the needs of people and their health care. And if there was that strong voice for taking care of persons if the companies don't want the liability, as there is in trying to protect themselves from liability, I think that there would be a lot more support on this floor for this kind of legislation. But at the same time, I would say to Senator Marty that and to others on the floor that this is not about abstaining from any liability at all. We must be very careful to understand the exact language here. It's not saying that there is not a liability for this company to help people who have asbestos-related problems. But it is limited to the market value, the fair market value. And if you want to set it, Senator Lance, by somebody other than the company, then do that instead of deep-sixing a piece of legislation that is reasonable. And it is the value of that company to that level that the company would accept liability for injury. And then we need to create another solution, another general solution for assisting these victims. And then I would like to make one more point about the issue of precedence, because we often talk about our concerns about the future precedence that something will establish, that some bad outcome will come from future precedence in terms of who underwrites the responsibilities for things if we relieve this company from the liability. But remember that we've come to this very same chamber and argued in the past for local small business gas stations who have gas or oil spills on land when they purchase it. And the government comes in and resolves the environmental issues on those properties. The government takes responsibility for that liability and supports that in order for it to not to be an excessive burden on businesses. This legislation does not avoid liability. It limits it to the value of the company that created the problems. If the company that purchased it, and only if the company that purchased it, has never profited or created revenue or income from the purchase of that company, and this company that Crown Cork specifically sold it off within a very brief period of time. Those are all very reasonable conditions for this body periodically to take a look at where a law is really unfair and to make the changes that it needs to in order to support a company and their capacity to grow. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it's true that they may pay some liability, but we totally limit the liability. And so what happens then when there still needs to be, when the victims are still needing to recover? They do go to the healthcare system, and while we may need to make changes in the healthcare system, I agree with that, we are the ones that are paying for this healthcare system. And we are the government does step in a lot and help people. And I'm really tired of government stepping in and bailing out companies or limiting their liability when a business deal goes wrong. We've seen it countless times in the past few years. And we are government stepping in, bailing out companies, and just because, you know, they made bad mortgages or whatever. But then when companies benefit, we don't see the benefit of that. We're the taxpayers. We help with our taxpayer money when things go wrong, but we don't benefit when things go right. This is another situation where we're stepping in to limit the liability of a company so that we, the taxpayers, are going to pay those health care costs for the victims and for victims that are harmed in companies, and we're giving them the ability to escape their own liability. They've taken over a company, and they are now responsible for that. And so, Madam Chair, I just ask members to oppose this very bad bill.
Further discussion on Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill is a shift to the taxpayers. It really is. You get mesothelioma, that's a $200,000-$400,000 in health care costs. And if you don't have your own health insurance, well, if you do have your own health insurance, your current employer will end up having that embedded in their experience rating, and they'll pay higher premiums. So every small business that has someone who might have been exposed to Crown Cork's asbestos better watch their premiums, because that one bad incident among their employee base is going to make a mess out of their health care insurance coverage. If they don't have that kind of health care insurance coverage, where are they going to go? Who's going to pay for it? The taxpayers of Minnesota will pay for it when they go on MA, when they get other public coverage, or be buried into the hospitals that we know are screaming on the burden of charity care as it is. So this is a shift. Make no bones about it. This would be a shift of the cost from Crown Cork, a Pennsylvania company that has $700 billion or $7.5 billion worth of business assets, to the taxpayers of Minnesota. Secondly, yes, sometimes the government does help take care of these circumstances. When, for example, you have gasoline spilled on a site, or when you have other contamination on a site, we have super funds. The government has decided we are going to establish funds to help clean up this contaminated land. And the federal government in CERCLA, Minnesota, has a super fund law as well. Well, if this bill were to include a $3 million fiscal note that said we are going to pay the cost instead of having the cost paid by Crown Cork, well, then we could make an informed decision whether or not we wanted to impose that burden on the taxpayers of Minnesota. But this bill doesn't have that. This bill just says Crown Cork doesn't have to pay. It's a hiding game, members. We're trying to hide that shift of costs. And indeed, Crown Cork, yeah, they made some money off of this. They sold off a part of the business.
So they did make some money on this after they operated it for some time as well. That cap that's in here on the liability for Crown Cork, I think they paid $7 million for Mundet. So there's your cap. They're long past that already in what they've paid out in liability. So they wouldn't have any exposure. And then next year, what's the next bill that's going to come before us next year or in 2 years? A bill that says just eliminate the pre-1972 condition from this law. So it will apply not only to Crown Cork, but then, okay, it'll come through one-line bill, delete that line, applies only to companies that purchased other companies before January 1, 1972. And it'll be billed as a small cleanup or a technical change or something like that. Is that what we want to do? Is that the kind of precedent that we want to set? Members, this is a really bad precedent, and it's a really bad deal for the taxpayers of Minnesota, let alone for the injured workers or families that are exposed to asbestos.
Further discussion on Senate File 1236. Oh, Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam President. Members, I'm wondering if you've been hearing this public conversation lately. I'm hearing from the governor and from the minority members in this chamber referring to businesses as contrivers, as those terrible wrongdoing participants, those terrible bad businesses. Aren't they just terrible? What is the deal? The businesses in Minnesota are our employers. They're the folks that are going to grow the economy. They are the Minnesotans, individuals, and families that have invested their own capital and have skin in the game. Why do we assume that they are so terrible? These are people that are putting their hard work, their talents, their skills, their resources at risk. And in this case, you have a business that has never been engaged in any activity that has created any harm to anybody. That's not the business that they're in. And so it's really surprising to me that we want to hold liable to what you've called innocent victims when they actually have no relationship whatsoever. The innocent victims that you talk about were harmed by the activities of a business that is out of business. That entity no longer exists. Why are we going to hold a completely unrelated business liable for harms that they can't possibly be responsible for except in some contrived lawsuit filed by a lawyer looking for deep pockets? That's what this is about. Now, I'm sorry if there are victims. I'm sorry if there are innocent victims. But sometimes those victims can't always find someone to compensate them for their harm. And that's what we do in public policy questions like this. We decide at what point should someone, a business, be held liable. And in this case, because this business has, and businesses like them, have never been engaged in the activities that caused harm to Minnesotans, they should not be held liable. And if you want to talk about the cost of doing business in Minnesota, this is one of them. Let's start holding businesses liable for acts and torts for activities they never, ever engaged in. That'll set a precedent in Minnesota. That'll surely make it hard to recruit new businesses to come to Minnesota. Other states don't have that standard, and we shouldn't have it here.
Further discussion, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would Senator Ortman yield for a question?
Senator Ortman will yield. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Senator Ortman. Senator Ortman, when a company acquires another company, do you think that they would benefit if that acquiring company helps them in their bottom line, if they would actually create a profit because of that other company? Do they benefit from the profits of that other company? Do they benefit? Do they become, do they benefit from those profits? if they become more profitable after acquiring the other company.
Senator Ortman.
Well, Madam President, I don't really understand the question, but I think with respect to this current set of circumstances, one company bought the assets of another company and never engaged in the same line of business that created the harm here. I think that's what we're talking about.
Madam Chair.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll clarify my question. If a company buys another company, they become one company. This happens all the time. If that one company now becomes profitable, do they get to keep their profits?
Sorry. Senator Ortman.
Well, Madam President, again, I don't really understand the question. However, I will say this, that when one company buys the assets of another company, they put their capital at risk, and sometimes profits result, and sometimes losses result. Anything could happen at that point. But the point that Senator McGuire seems to be glossing over because she wants to is the fact that in this case, the purchasing company did not engage in the portion of the business that caused the harm and should not be held liable.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it seems to me, just in the basic law of contracts and of businesses acquiring other businesses, when a business buys another business, they acquire the assets and liabilities of that business. That's the whole point of the purchase. And then they acquire the profits and the liabilities of that business. It's pretty basic business law. And so that's what we're talking about here. A business deal went bad, or, you know, there's more liabilities than they thought. They should have known. I might argue they should have known about it, but they claim they didn't, and it went bad, and now they want the state to step in. I want businesses to succeed in this state as well as everyone, but I want to be very careful about the precedents that we set. A business bought another business, becomes one business, they share profits, they share liabilities.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I think that I wasn't going to rise again, but I just want to make sure we're clear about what we're talking about in this bill, because I certainly wouldn't be supporting a bill that said that if a company buys another company's assets and liabilities, that they should not be held responsible for those liabilities, even though they were not in the business when those liabilities occurred. That's not what this bill is saying, and it's not what this bill is about. This bill says a very narrow situation in which a company buys its assets and liabilities and never engages in the business of the activity of asbestos-related activities. This company sold the company, never engaged in that activity, never was in the business, and other than selling the company for the value of the fair market value of the company, did not profit from any activities, should be held liable to the fair market value of the business, but not beyond that. So please be clear, not to mix this up with other arguments we have about whether once you purchase a company, that company holds those assets and also should be keeping with those liabilities. That's a very different subject than this bill is attending to.
Senator Ortman, did you indicate? Senator Latz.
Madam Chairman, members, just two brief additional points. One is I have in front of me a copy of a document that identifies two specific workers' compensation claims against Mundet from 1954 and 1955 that was a part of their records at the time that Crown Cork bought Mundet. So Crown Cork can't claim that they put their head in the sand. They certainly should have known about this. And secondly, I have to augment what I said about taxpayers picking up the costs here, because it won't only be the taxpayers. An article in the Washington Post, March 9, 2010, about the testimony in Virginia on exactly the same
proposal that's before us today. And by the way, this has been a national effort by Crown Court to pick off liability protections in states around the country. Testimony in the Virginia legislature, Owens, Illinois, Fortune 500 company, testified there, a glass manufacturer, a container manufacturer, argues that it would pay more in asbestos claims if Crown Cork was no longer held liable. So this would not only shift costs to taxpayers, it would shift costs to other businesses that will have to fill in the gap if there are claims in which you could find someone else to be liable, as I believe Senator Perry or Senator Thompson had said earlier, that you could go after someone else. And apparently in Virginia, the bill is also opposed by other manufacturers. So this isn't a clear-cut case of, are we going to vote for business or are we going to vote against business? This is picking and choosing between which businesses we think should be responsible and shouldn't be responsible for the companies, not just the assets, but the assets and liabilities that they purchase. Thank you.
Further discussion on Senate File 1236. Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to go back. I'm not an attorney, and I feel like my head is a metal ball going in a pinball machine right now. I'm not an attorney, but let me give you my layman's just bottom line as I look at this bill. A couple of things that I think need to be brought back. By the time of Crown Cork's stock purchase, we need to remember that Mundet had already closed its asbestos manufacturing operations. Then approximately 90 days after Crown obtained its stock ownership, which they were looking to purchase, a family-owned bottle cap company. That's it. There was nothing left. Mundet had sold everything. It was sold off, the inventory, the customer lifts, the idle machinery. We need to remember that. And as I take a look at this bill and I listen to all the great debate here, Crown Cork and Seal at the time did not know what was going to happen in 1972 when OSHA made its ruling on asbestos. Any viable company would have done their due diligence had it been public, had they known, would have left this company as a subsidiary. They did not know. They did not produce. They did not sell any asbestos-related products. They have been good corporate citizens. Over $750 million. How much is enough to an innocent company like this? How much is enough? They've proven themselves to be good. They haven't backed away from being included in these 30 to 36 different companies being pulled together. I look at it as common sense. They're not trying to run away from anything. They're just asking us, how much is enough? I also handed out for you page 2 on the limitations. I think we need to read them closely. This affects those prior to 1972 when knowledge was public about the issues of asbestos. But I want to bring it back, members. How much is enough?
Senator Perry renews his motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1236 be recommended to pass. There has been a roll call requested. The Secretary will take the roll. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 34 ayes and 27 nays, the bill is recommended to pass. Continuing under general orders, we'll move to number 8 on the general orders list, Senate File 1492, Senator Daley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File number 1492 be recommended to pass.
To that motion, Senator Daley.
Members, first let me thank all of the brave and courageous firefighters who risk their lives while keeping us safe, and to acknowledge those brave souls who have paid the ultimate sacrifice. As we are scrambling to get out of our homes or businesses to get away from the fire, they are rushing to our rescue. To all of you firefighters, thank you. Currently, the first Sunday in October is designated as Fallen Firefighters Memorial Day in honor of firefighters who have lost their lives in the line of duty. This bill changes the date to the last Sunday in September and will allow individuals who wish to attend memorial services at both the state and national levels to attend both. This is a bill brought to me by a constituent and passed unanimously in the state government committee, where fire chiefs spoke in full support of this change. Members, I ask for your support. Thank you.
Discussion to Senate File 1492. Seeing none, Senator Daley renews his motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1492 be recommended to pass. On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Remaining under special orders, number 9, Senate File 1073, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1073 be recommended to pass.
To that motion, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1073 is a recommendation from the Governor's Workforce Development Council. I believe there are handouts being passed out, so you can actually see that recommendation. Senator Kelash and I serve on this committee. And this bill's intent is to make sure that kids are prepared starting in grade 9 with a career and college place a path so that when they graduate, they will not need a remedial help, and also that they'll be prepared for post-secondary, whether that's career or college. Madam Chair, I'll just mention this is strongly encouraged. It is not a mandate.
Further discussion on Senate File 1073. Senator Wieger.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I offer the A1 amendment.
Secretary will report the amendment.
Senator Wieger moves to amend Senate File 1073 as follows. Page 2 after line 24, insert. This is the A1 amendment.
To the amendment, Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I commend Senator Nelson for recognizing the importance of students being college and career ready. It's a national goal. It's a state goal as a part of our accountability standards. And the report that was put together by the Workforce Council is excellent. However, we can provide a pep talk and go further as policymakers and actually say we're going to provide the resources or to give them the assistance to implement it. Today, by the way, is Counselor Day at the Capitol. And when we look at the provisions in the encouragement here that students be college and career ready, there's a number of things. And it focuses on a comprehensive academic plan, academic rigor, high expectations, etc. Minnesota has a crisis right now in counselors for the ratio. We are 49 out of 50 states, 777 students to each counselor. In addition to doing their best to address career counseling, they address mental health needs, students with family problems, depression, aggressive or disruptive behavior, anxiety, bullying. Testing demands are skyrocketing, budget cutbacks. Now, members, in the past, I have sponsored bills that would have a ratio that would put us at 400 to 1. Right now it's 777 to 1, and that is unacceptable. We will not get the job done at that type of ratio, and especially when we repealed the maintenance of effort in the previous session, it only further took a tool out of the toolbox for having the number of counselors we need. So, Madam Chair, I offer the amendment with the hope that schools, I give them several years to accomplish that, but if we're going to be serious for college career readiness, we need to have enough counselors to provide that. It's offered in that spirit.
Discussion.
And I would ask for a roll call vote.
Roll call has been requested, and a roll call will be granted on the A1 amendment. To the A1 amendment, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wieger, I appreciate your amendment, but I must rise to speak against this amendment. This is a mandate upon school districts, actually a mandate that we repealed last year. School districts can certainly hire the counselors that they believe are needed in their school district. I do not think that legislators sitting in St. Paul know every school district and exactly how they should staff their school district. I certainly do not know all the school districts in the state, and I would not vote to say that they need to maintain certain ratios.
Further discussion on the A1 amendment. A roll call has been requested. The secretary will take the roll on the Wieger A1 amendment. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 24 ayes and 36 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I offer the A2.
Secretary will report the amendment.
Senator Wieger moves to amend Senate file number 1073 as follows. Page 2 after line 24, insert. This is the A2 amendment.
To the amendment, Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Instead of a mandate, this would encourage. And I would make an oral amendment at line 1.4 between is and encourage, strongly encourage. This would parallel the language in Senator Nelson's encouragement to districts in the underlying bill at 1073. And I would ask for a roll call.
Roll call is granted. Senator Wieger, are you offering an oral amendment to your amendment?
Mr. Chair, correct.
Could you repeat it one time?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, at line 1.4, between the words is and encourage, insert strongly.
And you wanted a roll call on that, Senator Wigger.
Mr. Chair, no, not on the oral amendment, on the amendment itself.
All in favor of the amendment to the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Roll call has been called on the Wigger amendment. Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, would Senator Wigger yield?
Senator Wigger will yield.
Senator Wigger, I appreciate your emphasis on school counselors, and I certainly think that we need to make sure that every school district has the school counselors that are needed. Senator Wigger, have you checked with the Plainview Elgin Millville School District? Do they need to have a ratio of 400 to 1 in regards to counselors?
Senator Wigger.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, no, I did not check with that district. I have authored the recommendation for this ratio in the past, and it has been supported by counselors, but for this particular district, I don't have their input.
Senator Nelson.
Will Senator Wigger yield?
He will yield.
Senator Wigger, did you check this with Stuartville or Rochester, or what districts specifically need to have this ratio?
Senator Wigger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson. The school counselors, I'll reiterate, have said we are at crisis level staffing in Minnesota, 49 out of 50. And it is what it is. It's a crisis. And can districts do better? I wish. There's not enough resources. And through the relaxation and mandates, it has critically affected counselors. So it's made in behalf of counselors, which more importantly is in behalf of students. And Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, this language, like your bill, is a pep talk. It encourages. It does not mandate.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senator Wigger, I appreciate pep talks, and I appreciate the spirit in which this is given. My only question is, it's very definitive in the 400 to 1 ratio, and we just have no way of knowing if that's adequate for every school district in this state. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer an oral amendment to Senator Wigger's amendment.
What's your oral amendment?
On line 1.4, strike the word A, insert the word an, and the word adequate. Strike the words of 400 to 1 or better. Insert the words for its students. Would you like me to read that to you?
Please do.
A school district is encouraged to have an adequate student-to-counselor ratio for its students beginning in the 2015-2016 school year and later. I think this encompasses the spirit of Senator Wigger's amendment, but it does not mandate a certain ratio since every school district is different. The numbers out. Members, I encourage a yes vote.
Would the secretary reread it?
The oral amendment to the amendment would result in the reading of: a school district is strongly encouraged to have an adequate student to counselor ratio for its students beginning in the 2015, et cetera, et cetera. As would amend it.
Thank you. Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Nelson, really? Do you think that actually moves anything forward by just saying, gee, the school should think about having an adequate number of counselors for the students they have? I know that you don't like mandates and that you prefer to have encouragement, but this really doesn't move anything forward.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. And let me remind members to address your comments to the chair, please. I'm feeling there's a little too much emotion going back and forth, and that's the decorum that I would like to see. Senator
Mr. President.
I had Senator Nelson, Senator Higgins. Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I believe Senator Higgins asked me to yield. I didn't hear that, but I will answer her question. I believe that this oral amendment has the spirit and the intent of understanding how important counselors are, especially at this time, and I appreciate Senator Wieger for bringing this forward. However, my amendment, it does not mandate a specific ratio, which all of us represent very different school districts, and to assume that one school district has the very same needs as the next, I think is just a fallacy. So while I appreciate the importance of counselors and of Senator Wieger's amendment, I believe that my amendment to his amendment takes away, still preserves the individuality of individual school districts, and I do not feel that at this time it's wise to place mandates upon them.
Senator Wieger, were you still interested? Otherwise, I'll go to Senator Scoy. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, when you say shall in a bill, that's a mandate. When you say may or strongly encourage, it's not a mandate. It doesn't really result in anything because there's no ramifications if a school district isn't strongly encouraged. So Senator Wieger and Senator Nelson, I don't think either the amendment or the bill does very much because it doesn't have the word shall in it that they should actually do anything. So let's keep this debate where it should be focused.
No further discussion on the oral amendment to the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
Amendment does not prevail. We've had division. All those in favor, please stand. You may be seated. Those in the negative, please rise. You may be seated. There being 35 yea, the amendment, oral amendment, does prevail. On the amendment, as amended, we do have a roll call. Secretary will take the roll. Secretary will close the roll. There being 60 yeas and 0 nays, the amendment to the amendment the amendment as amended prevails. Further discussion on Senate File 1073. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, and to Senator Nelson. Senator Nelson, and Mr. Chair, I do appreciate your bringing this bill forward. There's certainly nothing negative about it. It's a very positive and very encouraging effort on behalf of students. But I think Senator Wieger properly pointed out the issue that is raised by legislation and efforts like this. It simply points out that, you know, we have school counselors in our schools, and they're overwhelmed. We have very, very capable folks who are doing their level best to help our kids on a number of fronts, not the least of which is their academics, their career planning, their post-secondary education planning, and they're simply swamped and they're underwater. So I appreciate that Senator Wieger brought this discussion forward. I hope it is a foreshadowing of some real effort to really dig in and talk about the fact that we have, you know, we're at the very bottom of the heap of all states in the entire country of our school students to counselor ratio. So I certainly won't oppose this. I think it's positive. By its very language, it encourages schools. It's not a mandate. So there's nothing really to oppose here. It's simply suggesting to schools to do something. But we really have the opportunity, perhaps, in the near future, to really give them the tools that they need, so we wouldn't have to have legislation like this, that they would simply be doing this, you know, to the order of magnitude, to the scale in which this kind of work actually needs to be done. One small concern is that on up at the top of the second page, appropriate counseling and other supports access really should be speaking about folks who are actually licensed, who are trained, who are the professionals who are a part of the trade that actually does this work, but I'm not going to nitpick or offer amendments. I thank you for the bill, but again, I think it highlights really the crisis and the problem that we have in our Minnesota schools with the lack of sufficient and adequate number of licensed counselors.
Further discussion. No, there being no further discussion on the bill as amended, Senate File 1073. Oh, Senator Nelson.
I just wanted to thank everyone for their input. Certainly, it is our intention that our school districts provide the best education for students and they be ready for college and career. I would encourage a green vote. Thank you, members.
On Senator Nelson's motion that Senate File 1073 be recommended to pass, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Moving to the next on general orders here, it will be number 11, Senate File 1371, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1371 be recommended to pass.
To that motion.
Members, this piece of legislation was brought to my attention by the Morrison County Sheriff. The bill relates to law enforcement agencies having the authority to sell contraband weapons to federally licensed firearm dealers, FFLs. Law enforcement agencies are not authorized by statute to sell them in certain situations, and instead contraband weapons must be destroyed unless they're used by the same agency for law enforcement purposes. This bill will allow them as an option to sell those firearms. Proceeds from the sale will be distributed under the current forfeiture formula, usually 70% to the local law enforcement agency, 20% to the prosecuting agency, and 10% to the general fund. Some fiscal considerations, they're positive. Local law enforcement indicated that they may end up savings to their departments, first because they will not have to pay for unused, unneeded weapons destroyed or stored, and second, they'll be able to use their portion of proceeds from the sale of the weapons. Finally, I'll say the bill is supported by law enforcement.
in committee, law enforcement agents or former law enforcement members that are now senators offered support. Law enforcement would not be selling these guns to people off the street. That was one of the issues that people were concerned with. But instead, they must sell them to dealers that must comply with federal requirements that include a background check. So what that means, members, is that it cannot be sold to a convicted felon. Finally, this bill requires law enforcement agency when they oh, I already said that, I'm sorry. Should the agency decide to set a policy to destroy all the forfeited weapons, they still may do so. Members, I ask for your support.
Further discussion on Senate File 1371, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate the work that Senator Gazelka has done on this, and certainly don't think it means the end of the world is at hand, but you know, I do. I am forced to wonder really what problem are we actually solving here. You know, I certainly don't see that there's a major shortage of guns in our marketplace, and you know, can't imagine that police agencies' primary role is selling guns and you know doing these gun sales, cookie sales to raise funds, and you know, really feel like it's really public safety agencies' primary responsibility to ensure the public safety and not simply to turn these guns back out. We have plenty of guns. You know, I've yet to hear what problem we're solving by this, members. I just don't see that this is a pressing problem that in need of a solution, and I'm not supportive of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion on Senate File 1371. Senator Gazelka renews his motion that Senate File 1371 be recommended to pass. All in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Moving on to the next order of business, number 12 on general order, Senate File 1123. Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1123 be recommended to pass.
On that motion, Senator Harrington.
Members, in 2007, the state of Minnesota enacted an innovative tool for public safety to prevent criminal gang violence. The tool is codified in statute and is commonly referred to as the Criminal Gang Injunction Statute, or CGI. The concept originated in California, and the idea is to, rather than clean up after gang violence, to enjoin gangs from being able to congregate in public venues, and particularly has been used in St. Paul at the Cinco de Mayo and at Rondo Days, and has been used with great effect, reducing gang violence and gang activity there. As they were applying this bill in 2009, law enforcement and the city attorney discovered that there was a statutory gap in the language. As they were researching the number of members of the criminal gangs, they found that they had juvenile members who were not able to be included in the class because they simply had been juveniles in possession of a firearm rather than juvenile delinquents adjudicated for a violent crime or felons. What this bill does is it includes them in the class potentially of criminal gang members that would be enjoined from coming to a particular event or particular location. There has been some concern expressed as to whether young people who are out taking target practice that I generally refer to as plinking might be affected by this, but that will not happen because in order for them to be included in this class, number one, they would have to be codified as a juvenile gang member, which would require them to have three or more of the conditions, also have other predicate offenses. They would also have to be members of a particular gang, which would have to meet state statute, and then finally that gang would have to meet the continuing gang activity standard of this particular bill. I have support from law enforcement, from city and county attorneys. We believe this is a good preventive bill that will prevent gang violence and prevent disruption from community events. And I would ask for folks' support as this bill comes forward.
Further discussion on 1123, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, or Madam President.
Madam Chair, since you asked, it's Madam Chair.
Thank you for the correction, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Senator Harrington, I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. This is a very responsible bill when it comes to the illegal possession and use of firearms, especially in our urban environments. This was a particularly good exercise in committee because it once again reminded us that in some parts of the state, gun violence is a little more prevalent than in others, and your attention to the inadvertent use or the intentional use, but in a lawful way, in rural parts of Minnesota, that the bill is not necessarily a one-size-fits-all, but it's sensitive to the cultural sporting nature of hunting in our rural areas of Minnesota. I think it's a very well-balanced bill, and it deserves our support.
Further discussion? Senator Hayden. Is this the first time you've spoken?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. It is the first time that I've got up today, and I would hate to get up on a bill in opposition to my friend and Senator Harrington, but I do have some concerns, and though I wasn't in judiciary and I haven't sat through the public safety aspect of it, I do know that there are great concerns in the community, in the communities that I live in, and frankly the communities that Senator Harrington not only lives in but also represents, about who's on the gang database. And if that gang database is inclusive of everybody that's in a gang. And I know that there had been a lot of work done on making sure that people who might have been affiliated or associated with someone that they knew or may not know that was a gang was on that gang database. And so I know that that is another issue, Senator Harrington, that we are working out. But I am very concerned that, especially as it relates to our young people, and we go to these cultural events, one of the things that we that the events that Senator Harrington is talking about, Rondo Days, Juneteenth in Minneapolis, Cinco de Mayo, are celebrations of one's cultural heritage. And to have young people not be able to attend because they might have been in a gang or they might be in a gang, I think it's something that we need to think about deeply as we start to figure out how to rehabilitate these young folks. And so I am awfully sensitive and most certainly probably won't win this argument today because we have such a smart and thoughtful senator as Senator Harrington, and he's had to deal with these issues over time. But I am very, very concerned as we start to add more things to the statute that prevent us from being able to talk to our young people, rehabilitate our young people. And frankly, though I know Senator Harrington is a fair and a just person and was a fair and a just cop, we do have sometimes police officers in our midst that take that overreach. And sometimes they look at folks and they don't want certain people in the way, or they may think that in the past that person has caused trouble. And so I know that that is not most of our law enforcement officials, but I do think that there is a history that sometimes the rank and file cop may have an issue with a particular person or may overreach in terms of their authority with people. So with great respect and not having followed the bill very closely, this brings me some pause and concern, and I won't be able to support the bill today. Thank you, Madam President.
Senator Harrington.
Madam Chair, in regards to my esteemed colleague's comments, two points of reference. One, that the bill was supported by the Rondo Dame, which is a black neighborhood group. They asked us to use this injunctive relief to make sure that their community event was safe. So this really was brought as the two cases that has been used in St. Paul were brought by communities of color to make sure that our community events could be safe. Secondarily, this doesn't actually enjoin the individual from being able to participate in community events. What it enjoins them from doing is to do it in a collective manner, so that what it effectively does is it says that a particular gang cannot march through the streets as a criminal organization and disrupt the peace and tranquility of the event. It doesn't prevent the individual coming there as a solo participant with his family and enjoying the peace and tranquility of the event. I really do believe that, in addition to that, this injunctive relief has to not only come from law enforcement, it has to be then approved by a city or a county attorney. It then has to go to a judge who has to issue an order. So there are several due process breaks within the use of the civil gang injunction, which I think makes it has made it very effective and yet has not been disruptive community events and has also made it not disruptive to communities of color. And I would ask for people's support.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Senator Hayden. Senator Hayden, I know that you're new to the Senate, but I want to thank you for bringing up the comments about the overreach of perhaps law enforcement that may be a little too zealous in certain neighborhoods of Minnesota. Although that is not the primary interest of this particular bill, and I'm in fear of being ruled out of order because I'm talking of a related subject, but I did want to let you know that for a long time, at least in the Minnesota Senate, we have been very cautious when it comes to the data privacy policy making here in the Senate. And I know that in the House, other state representatives also share that same caution. We do not want to make databases that spread such a wide net that they bring in people into data collection devices that would trail them or shadow them when they are not deserving of such a harsh labeling. And that, at least in the Senate Judiciary Committee, we're going to continue that caution as we continue to try and unravel and make good law for the people of Minnesota.
Further discussion on Senate File 1123. Seeing none, Senator Harrington renews his motion that when this committee do arise, that Senate File 1123 be recommended to pass. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion does prevail. Senator Senjum.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, I move that the committee now do arise and report.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair, I move that the report of the committee of the whole as kept by the secretary be now adopted.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Moving on to the 13th order of business. Announcements of Senate interest. I do have several excuses. I have several excuses without objection. The following senators will be excused. Senator Sparks, Senator Pappas, Senator Goodwin, all day. Senators Gazelka and Senator Michelle from 11 to 11:15. Senator Bach and Senator Cohen from 12 o'clock to the end of session. And Senator Koch from 12 o'clock to the end of session. Without objection, they will be excused. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam President. Madam President, the Judiciary Committee will be meeting rather than at 1 o'clock, at 1:15. Members can get a quick bite to eat, and then promptly at 1:15, we'd like to get started.
Further announcements, Senator Gimsey.
Madam President, the Senate Transportation Committee will be starting immediately after session today at 1 o'clock. We have a number of bills that we want to get fit in our hour and a half.
Further announcements of Senate interest. Senator Senjum.
Madam President, the business of the Senate now being concluded, I do move that we adjourn until Monday, February 20th at 12 noon.
Senator Senjum has moved we adjourn until Monday, February 20th at noon. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. We are adjourned.